You are listening to the RTE Brainstorm Podcast, proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Hi, my name is Ella McSweeney, and this is Brainstorm. If you want to know about new ideas from the world around you, then this is the podcast for you. In 2003, a 1.6 billion euro robot called Juice took off from Earth on an 8-year journey to Jupiter, and three Irish researchers are involved. Professor Katrina Jackman is from the University of Limerick, and Dr. Mika Holmberg is from Uppsala University in Sweden. Katrina, you might start by just describing Jupiter. I was reading about it. I don't think I fully understood or fathomed just how enormous it is compared to the Earth.
Jupiter is an amazing planet. It's by far the biggest planet in the solar system. It's also the planet that has the strongest magnetic field. It has the most powerful auroras, like the northern lights that we see here on Earth. And so everything about Jupiter is kind of at a super scale compared to the Earth.
Is this one of the reasons why I suppose we're so fascinated by it? The fact that we can actually see it helps. It's so large and bright in the sky.
I think that's one of the reasons why I just love being a planetary scientist, is it's tangible to me. You know, I'm working on these spacecraft that we're sending to the outer solar system, but yet I can go into my back garden and look up into the night sky and see Jupiter and think about the spacecraft that are currently there or the spacecraft that are on the way to there. So for me, that really makes the connection between the spacecraft that we build here on Earth with these amazing instruments and then the place that we're sending them to.
One of the first people to study Jupiter was Galileo back in, when it's 1610 or whatever. I mean, what did he find out? What did he observe from Earth?
Well, the discovery of anything in the solar system, you know, comes about in stages. And so the first stage, of course, is just initially to look with the naked eye and then to look with increasingly sophisticated telescopes. So Galileo had what at the time was a state-of-the-art telescope, but nothing compared to what we have now. And so over the years, as we have observed Jupiter, our knowledge has just increased and increased and increased. And so we begin to look at it and we see that maybe it's not all one color. And then when we start to improve the resolution of our imagery and improve our telescopes, we see, oh, actually, those different colors are arranged in stripes, in these kind of horizontal bands. And then we see, oh, there's a concentration of red there. And that's what we now know as the Great Red Spot. And so as we get more sophisticated with our ability to image the planet, we get to see finer and finer detail of those upper cloud layers, which are Jupiter's atmosphere. And then, of course, as we send spacecraft to orbit the planet up close, we learn even more about the amazing system.
Mika, talk a bit about this Great Red Spot that is on Jupiter. I gather it is two times the size of Earth, this spot alone. What is it?
So it's a massive storm that is raging on Jupiter. And in fact, if you have the opportunity to go to your local telescope, you can come and visit us at the Danzig Observatory, for example. You should really take the opportunity to have a look at this Great Red Spot now, because research shows that it is actually decreasing in size. And who knows, at some point it will disappear. So go and have a look if you get the chance.
Jupiter itself is called the gas giant. What gases is it made up of mainly?
It's hydrogen and helium mainly. And there are also other elements, but that's the main ones.
Katrina, you might talk a little bit about that. I mean, the fact it is mainly made up of hydrogen and helium as well, but hydrogen is there. I mean, is that one of the main reasons why we are interested in learning more about it?
One of the things that I find fascinating about the composition of the solar system is that it traces back to the formation of the solar system itself, because all the planets, all the material in the solar system formed initially from this big disk of gas and dust. And so because Jupiter is the biggest planet and it contains by far the most material, it gives us the best insight into the origin of the solar system. But one other thing, and I have small children myself, and for anyone listening who is a small child or has a small child in their house, the textbooks that I learned from when I was in school are different to the textbooks that my children are learning from now, because we understand more now about what's inside Jupiter. So early textbooks would have said primarily hydrogen and helium, and that absolutely is the case. But now that we're able to measure more finely, we're actually able to see what are the other materials that are there and what's the precise composition of those materials and how are they kind of ordered in height in the atmosphere of Jupiter and what's at the core and what's in the clouds. And that sort of finer information is really, really important for linking to the processes that, that formed the solar system. And it really just shows for me how even in a generation from me to my children, we change, we literally rewrite the textbooks on the solar system as we send spacecraft and we measure more and more precisely what these amazing planets are made of.
And when you say formed, I mean, we're talking about, I mean, how many billions of years ago? 4-5 billion years ago?
Yes, yeah. The scales are kind of quite hard to get your head around at times, yes.
And in that time, in the time that we have been looking at Jupiter, so, you know, Galileo in 1600s through his telescope, but in more recently with space exploration, what have we learned about the planet itself?
So some of the key things from the perspective of the research that, that our group does is we've learned that the planet has a really, really strong magnetic field, the strongest magnetic field of any planet in our solar system, that it has auroras like northern lights, the northern and southern lights that we see here on Earth. The auroras on Jupiter, several hundred times or up to several hundred times stronger than the auroras on the Earth. We see them in lots of different wavelengths. We see them in ultraviolet and infrared, like heat signatures that Jupiter is giving off. We see X-rays from Jupiter. We learn a huge amount about the moons of Jupiter. And so we learn about the moon Io, which is one of the most volcanic moons in our solar system. And that's spewing about 1 ton per second of sulfur into the environment near Jupiter. And then we learn about the other moons like Europa and Ganymede and Callisto, these other moons that are called the Galilean satellites because they were discovered by Galileo. And they are the most likely place beyond Earth to potentially host life. So there are some really exotic environments in the environment of Jupiter, and we're learning more and more about them every year.
Mika, there are, as far as I read, the last time there was something like 95 moons around Jupiter, but these four main ones that Katrina mentioned there, Io, Europa, Ganymede and Callisto, just describe what it is. You're focusing, I gather, on Ganymede. What is it you're trying to find out?
Yes, so as Katrina said, those moons, Europa, Ganymede and Callisto, those three are a special focus for our JUICE mission. So that stands for Jupiter Icy Moons Explorer, which it was launched in April 2023. And this mission is especially focused on those moons because, as Katrina said, we believe that there could potentially be life there. And this mission is going there to explore the habitability of these moons. So when I say habitability, it means that we will explore if these moons could be able to host life on them. So these moons are believed to have these vast saltwater oceans underneath their ice surfaces. And it's in these oceans that they could potentially be alien life forms.
And we think of the Earth, Katrina, as being watery. I mean, it's perhaps dry compared to the moons around Jupiter, particularly these moons, Ganymede and Europa and Callisto, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. Europa in particular is thought to have a really significant ocean. And these are the kind of measurements that this JUICE spacecraft is going to make. It's going to look to measure any ocean is, whether those oceans are global, i.e. whether they go all the way around the moon or whether they're maybe deeper in parts or shallower in other parts. And I think it's really important to for everybody to understand that this mission is not hunting for life. This mission is hunting for the conditions that can support life. And if it is found that those conditions are met, either now or if they were met at some point in the past, Then we would plan to go back with a different mission that has more dedicated instrumentation to hunt specifically for that life.
And what, Katrina, are you specifically looking for? I mean, obviously, we know water. I mean, where there's water, there's very high potential. There's going to be life there. But what else are you looking for that will indicate that there is a possibility that some forms of life, the types we don't know, but some forms of life may be there?
Well, Mika already mentioned salty oceans, and that's another key for supporting life. And so if we think about what do we need for life to thrive? Well, we need liquid water, and we need a source of energy. And then we need a very particular chemical soup to sustain life. And so the saltiness or the salinity of these oceans is one key metric that we are going to measure specifically with the instruments on JUICE to give us a sense of whether life could exist in those particular oceans.
Mika, at the bottom of the oceans on Earth, we have these big vents where there is salt water, there is this chemical soup, and there is also energy coming up from the middle of the Earth. There is no sunlight there, but we know that there's a lot of life there. What can we learn about these vents, and how can we, I suppose, interpret what may be on these moons around Jupiter?
Yes, exactly right. So we call them hydrothermal vents, and they are found on Earth, on the seabed, really deep in the ocean. And when these first were explored, the researchers who were exploring them didn't expect to find any life forms there, but instead, the life around the hydrothermal vents were really thriving. There were a lot of different microbes, there were corals, there were worms, and really a lot of different lives. So, and those are found, like, I think the deepest ones that are found is 5,000 meter down. So there is really, as you say, no sunlight there, but life is still thriving. So we believe that potentially there could be those hydrothermal vents in the seabed on these moons as well, and their life could thrive as well.
So it shows that you don't need the sun's energy to have life.
Exactly.
And therefore, exactly, there's a high possibility, we'll say, that on these very oceanic moons, there may be life down there.
Yes, yes. So as long as you have a source of energy, it doesn't have to be sunlight. So that's really exciting.
Do you have any ideas of what kind of life might be on, we'll say, Ganymede?
Well, I mean, most likely it's forms of microbes, but there could also be more advanced species present, like the ones I said, for different corals, worms, mussels, shrimps and fish, for example. But also we're talking about alien life forms here. So there is also the potential that we don't really have any means of classifying them, because they might be so different from the life that we have on Earth that, yeah, they don't fit into our classifications, but we'll see. We will find out.
And you say you will find out, because anything to do with space takes an awful lot of time, Katrina, doesn't it? You have this Jupiter Icy Moons Explorer, costs something like 1.6 billion euro to make. Can you describe what it looks like?
So the spacecraft itself is at the center of two very, very large solar panels. And so those are used to power all of the instruments and to power the communications that send all of the precious data back to Earth. So it was launched in April 2023, the solar panels unfurled in all their glory. And then you've got this spacecraft at the center. And the instruments that we at DIAS work specifically on are called RPWI, which is the radio and plasma wave instrument, and then PEP, which is a plasma or charged particle sensor. And, you know, you say it takes a long time to make these discoveries, and that is absolutely the case. You know, JUICE is not going to get to Jupiter until 2031, but we're very busy between now and then. And so the first real test of the JUICE spacecraft was just last year in summer 2024, where we had a flyby of Earth and Earth's moon. And that was our first chance to really test the instruments on JUICE, to measure the relatively well-known environment near the planet Earth and near our own moon, and just to check what the instruments were going to return and to see that everything was working well. And so Mika in particular, along with others in our group, are working really intensively at the moment on analyzing those first data from JUICE and then just building that excitement for when we actually get to Jupiter. But it's just, for me, it's so inspiring to be part of a mission like this because, you know, we sort of throw around words like alien life forms and habitability, and we get so used to saying them, sometimes we don't even stop to think what that actually would mean if we were to find that habitability is possible in these environments. So our day-to-day work involves a lot of intensive mathematics and computing, running really sophisticated computer models and simulations. But it's really cool even just to talk to you and remind ourselves that the reason why we're doing these simulations and the reason why we're doing all these calculations is to get to the core of one of the most important questions for humanity, which is, you know, are we alone? Is it possible that there's other life forms out there somewhere? It's great to be a part of.
I mean, just to get back to basics, this robot that, as you say, launched in April 2023, it's going to take 6.5 years to get to Jupiter. Is it a straight trajectory? Like I get in my car and I drive into work, or do you have to go every which way with the robot itself?
We take a bit of a roundabout tour of the solar system. And the reason for that is really fuel efficiency. And so we use what we call gravity assists. So we use the gravity of other large objects in the solar system, usually other planets, to just give us a bit of a slingshot and to kind of propel us on towards Jupiter. And so the reason for those flybys of other planets is primarily a gravity assist, but it also gives us an opportunity, as I said, to test the instruments and to check that everything is working, to test how we send commands to the spacecraft, to test how we receive data back.
So is this like a kind of catapult? So instead of using the fuel that the actual robot needs, because it can't possibly hold 6.5 years worth of fuel going out to Jupiter, you're using gravity to catapult it into space?
Yes. So you use these flybys to change the speed and the direction of the spacecraft. And the mission planners are amazing. They're a brilliant set of scientists and engineers, and they will get us to Jupiter exactly on time and exactly in the right place to be captured in orbit around the planet and to have then this time of exploration of the Jupiter system and these exotic moons.
And Mika, it's hard to imagine this unless you have a good map of space, but it left the Earth in April 2023. It went out to space, and then August the 19th and August the 20th of last year, it came back and did what's called a flyby by the moon and the Earth. Can you just describe what happened, why it happened, and the days itself, and where you were and what you were doing?
Yeah, exactly. So as you said, JUICE was launched in April 2023, and then it was set on a course around the sun. So it did a full orbit around the sun. And then it was catching up with us again, the Earth and our moon, in August 2024. So a little bit more than a year it took. And it was doing this, as Katrina said, in order to change its speed and its direction. And it was doing this, we call it a double gravity assist. And it's actually the first double gravity assist that has ever been performed. So we were quite nervous about this because it needs to be very, very precise, but everything went perfectly. And now what this gravity assist did was actually to slow us down a bit, because now we are on orbit again around the sun, but we're aiming to meet up with Venus next year. So that's the next gravity assist that we will be doing. And after that, we will do two more near the Earth, and then we're going out to Jupiter. So we're really going around the sun quite many times, but we're doing this in order to save fuel.
So last August the 19th, at about 10 o'clock at night, it went by the moon. The next day on August the 20th, at around 11 o'clock at night, it went by the Earth. Can you just describe, were you looking at a big screen? How does it work from a scientific point of view? What are you observing?
Yes, so you don't get the data directly. There is some delay in that. But I was following Mission Control. I was listening into them. They had some scientists that were visiting them and answering questions. And they were telling us how it was going with the flybys and if there were some adjustments that had to be done. But everything was prepared so well that they didn't really have to do anything. They could just sit, lean back and answer the questions. So, yeah. We were very happy about it.
And I gather, Katrina, I mean, this was high stakes stuff. As you say, this had never happened before. Two gravity assists within a day. There was a lot of planning. It all seems so difficult to understand when you're not a space scientist. But from your point of view, it must have been quite a nervy time, those 2 days last August.
It can be, for sure, because the risk is high. If something goes wrong, you could potentially lose the spacecraft. It could go off on a trajectory that you don't have control over. And so it's really important to get these things right. But it can't be understated how much planning goes into every aspect of a space mission, from trajectory design to instrument build to spacecraft test. So everything has been calculated, you know, to the nth degree. And so, of course, it's natural to feel, you know, nervous excitement. But we do really trust the engineers and they did a fantastic job.
So it'll catapult to Venus by next August. It'll fly by Venus and people might be able to get a sight of it then. And then it's due to be out by Jupiter by 2031. Is that correct?
That's right.
Yeah. So by 2031, out by Jupiter, what is going to happen at the point where it gets to Jupiter? Is it going to focus on any one particular moon?
Once it comes to Jupiter, we have different phases of the mission at that point. So first, it's going to orbit, around Jupiter, and it's going to study Jupiter itself. It's going to study Jupiter's space environments. It's going to do a couple of flybys of the moons. And then the last part of the mission, then we're going into orbit around Ganymede. So Ganymede is a very special moon. It's actually the largest moon in our solar system. And it's the only moon that we know of that has its own magnetic field. And that creates this kind of magnetic bubble around the moon that is called the magnetosphere. So it's also the only moon that has its own magnetosphere. So it's quite a special object. And on top of that, of course, it has this saltwater ocean under its icy surface, and that makes it potentially habitable. So it's really a special moon. So when we go into orbit around the moon, it is actually the first time that a spacecraft will be orbiting a moon other than the moon of the Earth. So it's also another first that JUICE will be doing. So quite exciting.
And will it land on Ganymede?
So in order to dispose of the spacecraft in the end, so when we do these kind of missions and there could potentially be alien life forms nearby, you know, for Mars or for these moons, we have to make sure that we dispose of the spacecraft properly. So the plan is actually to crash the spacecraft into the moon after. It's a controlled crash, so it's on purpose, to do that by the end of the mission. And that it's done in order for it to be disposed of and not contaminate the other moons or Ganymede as well. So
along that way, I mean, it's a cinematic end, isn't it, to crash into the moon itself. But Katrina, along the way, what is the data that you're collecting? Are you getting any physical samples or how does it work?
So we're not collecting any physical samples with this mission, but we are taking lots of images. We're taking data using the radio instrument that I mentioned earlier. We're taking data with a plasma sensor. So we're measuring the charged particle environment. We're looking at dust. We're looking at different wavelengths of emission from the moons and from the Jupiter system. So all these data sets are held initially by the instrument teams. So, for example, the radio instrument that we at DIAS work on is led by a team in Sweden. So each team will get the data from their particular instrument and try and analyze it locally, and then there are big science team meetings where all of the instruments teams come together and compare and contrast, you know, what kind of dust did we see? What kind of ultraviolet information did we receive from that sensor? What kind of radio waves did we pick up? And just piece all those bits of the puzzle together to get a sense of what's going on in the system. So it's just so cool and so exciting to be really at the forefront of a mission like this, because you're the first people in the world to get to see this brand new data.
And if you forward wind, Katrina, I don't know, 100 years, 200 years from now, is all of this essentially, I mean, it's obviously that big question that you said, are we alone or not? But is it all essentially about resources? Because we are depleting the earth and have depleted the earth. And obviously we're in the whole climate change thing. But at the end of the day, we're looking for other places to live, but also other places that may have important resources for us to be able to continue as a species.
That's one way to look at it, for sure. I think certainly people who study the Earth's moon, you know, are looking at the resources that could be mined from there. I think from my perspective, looking particularly at the moons of Jupiter helps us locally to understand perhaps our own oceans and how life might thrive in our own oceans. So initially, it's kind of making those links. But again, as I mentioned earlier, for me as a scientist and someone who's interested in exploration, it just comes back to discovery and really that wow factor of space and thinking that we are playing our part in rewriting the textbooks about the solar system. We will make new discoveries with this mission. That will mean that the next generation of young students who are learning about the solar system will have a different set of facts about what's happening at these moons. And, you know, it's really nice as Irish-based scientists to be able to play a part in such a big mission like that. And we do that through our membership of the European Space Agency and through our involvement in this mission.
And Mika, I mean, I suppose, you know, space exploration, things move very fast in many ways in that you're gathering so much information. There's so much not known. But really, it is quite a fundamentally slow process. I mean, 6.5 years to even get to Jupiter. And at that point, then you get the data and you then spend, you know, however long actually analysing the data. It's a reasonably slow process to be a space researcher.
Absolutely. Many of the missions that we are planning right now, the people who are most involved in planning them, they will be retired when the data is coming in. So when you work in this field, you're really working for the next generation and the generation after that generation. So you have to have that in that kind of mindset in order to work with those missions. I'm very grateful to the scientists who started thinking about the JUICE mission, because now I can be involved in working with the data and maybe they are already retired. So
it's a bit like planting a tree, Katrina, isn't it? I mean, you're giving something on for the next generation.
Absolutely. And I think Mika was very delicate there when she said retired. That might not have been the words that I would use. But absolutely, it's you're passing from one generation to the next when you're talking about outer solar system missions, because, you know, you're up to a decade of flight time to get there, as well as, you know, a decade to plan and build. And in terms of, you know, next steps for the solar system, there is an ice giant definition team at the moment. So Jupiter is a gas giant along with Saturn, but Uranus and Neptune, the next two planets out, are ice giants. And there is a plan by NASA and the European Space Agency, or a hope, I should say, to go to one of those ice giants at some point in the next 10 to 20 years. Probably going to be Uranus, although Neptune is equally a really fascinating environment. But those missions are, you know, 10 up to 20 years perhaps in the planning, and then, you know, 10 to 15 years or more in the execution. So it's very much a long game.
It's a long game. And I just wonder, I mean, I'm touching wood as I say this, Katrina, but with JUICE, is there at all stages the potential that you wake up one morning and you get the news it has exploded, it has disappeared, something's happened to it, it's not happening again?
It's always a possibility. I mean, there's a couple of really key crunch points in any mission. Launch, of course, is a biggie. Any trajectory maneuver, like the Earth-Moon flyby where you're firing thrusters and you're having a change to the speed and direction of the spacecraft, that's always a bit of a nail biter. The Jupiter orbit insertion maneuver is another big one to make sure that you can slow down the spacecraft sufficiently from its interplanetary cruise to be captured by the gravity of Jupiter and successfully go into orbit there. So yeah, absolutely. There are several crunch points, and you know, there are many missions in the past that have failed. I think of one example, I used to have a piece of it on my desk, an example of a mission called Cluster, which on its first launch, it disintegrated 38 seconds after launch. There was a software error. And then bits of it ended up in a swamp in French Guiana, actually, from where JUICE was launched. But 4 years later, they regrouped and they rebuilt the spacecraft and they went again. And those cluster spacecraft orbited the Earth for more than 20 years. So, you know, we go to space because it's fascinating. We go to space because we can make huge new breakthroughs and really important discoveries. And it's so inspiring and it's such a rich environment for exploration. But it's hard to get there and there is risk involved, but it's a calculated risk. And fingers crossed, so far so good with JUICE, and we're just really excited about what the future holds.
So Mika, 2031, I presume your diary is cleared for that. I mean, just how excited are you for the prospect, for the moment that the Jupiter orbit insertion happens and your robot is there and is circling Ganymede?
Oh, I'm really excited. But I should say that I'm not sitting and just waiting around. We're already working with the data and trying to, you know, get to know our instruments really well. We have the data from the lunar and Earth gravity assist that we're already working on. We're doing preparation studies, like checking what we can see with our instruments once we are around in orbit around Jupiter and Ganymede. So we're doing a lot of studies already. But of course, I'm super excited for the orbit insertion.
Just for any young people who are listening, because of the timescale for planetary missions, you know, if you're in secondary school now and you're thinking of going to college to do a physics degree or a maths degree or computer science, you can be the generation who will analyze data from missions like this, because by the time you finish your studies, you know, JUICE will be there. And so I think that's a really exciting opportunity for the next generation.
Many thanks to Mika Holmberg and Katrina Jackman. For more, go to rte.ie/brainstorm, and you can find Brainstorm in all the usual social places. We'd love to hear your thoughts on today's episode, and subscribe to Brainstorm wherever you get your podcasts. My name is Ella McSweeney. Until next time.
Brainstorm is produced by Adrian Carty. Research was by Hazel O'Leary and recorded by Shane Dempsey at Collaborative Studios. For RTE Brainstorm, thanks to Jim Carroll, Aoife Ryan Christensen and Neil Lane.
The RTE Brainstorm podcast is proudly supported by Research Ireland.